This is Wealth Wake Up with Dick Donahue and Camille Koppenberg on KGMI News Talk 790, 96.5 FM in Bellingham and KGMI.com.
The opinions voiced on Wealth Wake Up with Dick Donahue and Camille Koppenberg are for general information only and not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine what is appropriate for you, consult a qualified professional. Investment advisory services offered through CWM LLC, a registered investment advisor. Carson Partners is a division of CWM LLC, a nationwide partnership of advisors. Guests on Wealth Wake Up with Dick Donahue and Camille Koppenberg are not affiliated with CWM LLC.
Welcome back to Wealth Wake Up. Dick Donahue with you this Sunday morning here on KGMI. We'll look for the GDP to soar in the third quarter. There's nothing normal about the 2020 recession. Massive nationwide shutdowns or non-essential businesses caused real GDP to drop at a 31.4% annual rate in the second quarter, the biggest drop since the 1930s. However, as we expected, a V-shaped recovery is being traced out. On October 29th, in about 5 days, we expect a report that says third quarter real GDP rebounded at a 33.4% annual rate. We may make some minor adjustments in this forecast when new reports on business investment, inventories, and international trade are released, but the third quarter will still be one of the larger jumps in output the U.S. has ever experienced. It's important to keep in mind that even this huge V-shaped bounce will leave third quarter real GDP 2.9% lower than it was a year ago. And without the shutdowns, the U.S. would have grown at 2.5% versus a year ago. This means the economy will be about 5.3% smaller than it would have been in the absence of COVID-19. And even with the above trend in the year ahead, say 4.5% annually, the fact that many industries remain highly restricted while many businesses have declared bankruptcy means that the 5.3% gap will take some time to close. Without the full reopening, the economy will likely take until 2023 to get back where it would have been otherwise. If we do reopen and don't shut down again, it should happen faster. That said, the sharp rebound in third quarter is a testament to the underlying strength of the U.S. economy before the shutdowns happened, combined with the seemingly unlimited ingenuity of the American people. 20 years ago, without the technology we have today, there is no way that the U.S. could have rebounded as quickly as it did in the third quarter. Moreover, the U.S. entered this government-mandated recession with the highest incomes and the lowest poverty rate that we have ever recorded. Here's how we calculate the good news on an annualized 33.4% rebound in real GDP in the third quarter. First of all, let's look at consumption. Car and light truck sales rose at a 246% annual rate in the third quarter. And while the inflation-adjusted retail sales outside the auto sector grew at a 49.8% annual rate, spending on services also rebounded, but not quite as sharply. Much of service consumption is related to home occupancy, which didn't drop in the second quarter and didn't require a rebound in the third quarter. Also, limits remain on restaurants and bars, movie theaters, and other travel-related services. As a result, we estimate that the real consumer spending on goods and services combined increased at a 38.9% annual rate, adding 26.1 points to the real GDP growth rate, 38.9 times the consumption rate share of the GDP, which is 67%, equals 26.1. Now, business investment. Business investment in equipment rebounded sharply in the third quarter, while investments in intellectual property likely rebounded at a more moderate pace, and commercial construction continued to fall, the latter of which reflects little need for more office space or hotels. Combined, business investment looks like it grew at a 22.4% annual rate, which would add 3.1 points to real GDP growth. 22.5 times 14% investment share of GDP equals 3.1. Then home building. Residential construction revived rapidly in the third quarter, as much further to go, with a renewed desire for more space in the suburbs and a housing shortage in many places around the country. We estimate growth at a 15% annual rate, which would add 0.6 points to the real GDP growth. Then there's the government. It's hard to translate growth in overall government spending into a GDP effect because when calculating GDP, only direct government purchases of goods and services counts. Redistribution, which is borrowing from our kids to spend today, shows up in other categories. Our best guess is that government purchases, especially for healthcare and PPE, rose quickly, just like the second quarter. We estimate the growth at a 10.7% annual rate, which would add about 2.1 points to real GDP. And because GDP only accounts for spending today, there is no offset for the deficit that we would be spending from the future. Talk about trade. The trade deficit continued to grow in July and August as imports revived faster than exports. At present, we're projecting the net growth of exports will subtract an unusually large 3.1 points from real GDP in the third quarter, although data out in this next week on the trade deficit in September may alter this estimate, as well as our estimate of overall real GDP. And inventories. Inventories likely continued to fall in the third quarter, but not nearly as fast as they did in the second quarter, adding around 4.6 points to real GDP growth. Yes, we know it seems weird that inventories could keep falling but add to GDP, but that's how the math works out. If inventories decline by less than they did during the previous quarter, then smaller negative ends up adding to or subtracting less GDP growth. So let's add it all up and we get a 33.4% annualized real GDP growth in the third quarter. We look for more growth in the quarters ahead, but nothing anywhere close to this pace. And let's take a look at the global economic outlook and reports for this week. And the market is stalling on the next wave of the pandemic and the lack of the U.S. stimulus. So global equities declined for the week, while the yield on the benchmark U.S. Treasury note stretched a four-month high of 0.85% from 0.75 a week ago. The price of a barrel of West Texas Intermediate crude oil dropped slightly to $44.44, and volatility as measured by the CBOE Volatility Index, or VIX, rose to 28.5 from last week's 26.8. Let's look at this worldwide global macro news on the COVID-19 wave, which is gaining strength. The number of coronavirus cases around the world surpassed 40 million, according to Johns Hopkins University, as parts of Europe and the United States struggle to deal with an alarming surge of cases. In Europe, the second wave began in August, following the relaxation of national lockdowns implemented in the spring. European governments have scrambled to contain the surge in cases by reintroducing a raft of restrictive measures on public life and the hospitality sector, including the closure of limited opening of pubs, bars, restaurants, restricting social gatherings, and even resorting to curfews. Daily new cases in the U.S. continue to rise in more than half the states as debate rages over the effectiveness of public safety measures touted by the country's top health experts. In addition, a top UK scientist said that the coronavirus is likely to become as epidemic and as endemic as the flu, and a vaccine might not be able to stop it. This is Dick Donahue with you with Wealth Wake Up here on KGMI. We'll be back after a short break.
If tomorrow all the things were gone, I'd work for all my life, and I had to start again. Just my children and my wife.
Welcome back to Wealth Wake Up. Dick Donahue with you this Sunday morning here in KGMI. Let me give us a call. We're Asset Advisors. We are located out on the Pacific Highway. This next to Wilson's Furniture. Our address is 5060 Pacific Highway, Suite 101, Ferndale, 98248. Our phone number, 360-733-1200. Give us a call. Check us out. Also, check out our website, As we announced yesterday, we got another webinar coming up for clients and prospects and listeners and whoever this Thursday. If you're interested, give us a call on Monday, tomorrow, and talk to Camille, 733-1200. We'd be glad to send you the links and have you join us. Okay, let's talk about Americans are still waiting for a stimulus deal. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said the Democrats and the White House are moving closer to a coronavirus stimulus deal, but she cautioned that it could take a while for Congress to write and vote on relief legislation. The House Speaker said the sides have still come to a consensus on several issues that include aid to state and local governments, liability protection for businesses, and funding for the U.S. Census and election systems. Similarly, Goldman Sachs opined that there is little chance that Congress will pass an economic stimulus bill before the November 3rd U.S. elections. And the Chinese economy is beaming a ray of light. Data released by China showed that its economy recovery continues to gather steam, with third quarter GDP growing at 4.9% compared to a year ago. That brings growth first 3 quarters of the year to 0.7% from a year ago. Slower recovery in Chinese consumption remains a drag, with retail sales contracting 7.2% in the first 9 months of 2020 from a year ago. However, retail sales rose 3.3% in September and increased 0.9% in the third quarter. Industrial production rose 6.9% in September from a year ago, bringing total growth for the first 9 months of the year to 1.2%. The International Monetary Fund expects China will be the only major world economy to grow this year at a rate of 1.9%. And there's a lower possibility of a Brexit deal. British government Prime Minister Michael Gove says that there is less than a 50% chance of Brexit deal being reached by year end. Earlier this month, he assigned a 66% probability of the deal. If an agreement is not concluded by January 2021, UK and EU businesses will default to World Trade Organization rules, face higher costs and barriers to trade. The declining probability coincides with new comments from Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who advised British businesses to prepare for a no vote. As talks resumed, the European Union, a top Brexit negotiator, Michael Barnier, took a more optimistic tone. He said that a trade deal is within reach if both sides are willing to work constructively and be willing to compromise. Let's look at some of the global quick hits this week. Since World War II, a higher stock market going into a U.S. presidential election has signaled that the incumbent president or his party would win the election. There were two occasions during the periods of unrest and disruptions in 1968 and 1980 when the country was experiencing unrest or disruption and the incumbents were not reelected. Business sentiment in Canada has improved as coronavirus restrictions have eased, though it remains negative, with one-third of firms saying that they do not expect sales to return to pre-pandemic levels within the next 12 months, according to a Bank of Canada survey. And new filings for jobless claims in the U.S. totaled 787,000 last week. 875,000 were expected. This is the lowest total since the early days of the pandemic. Sales of existing U.S. homes jumped 9.4% in September. We're up 21% on an annual basis. According to the National Association of Realtors, the inventory of new homes fell 19% over the last year. There are only 2.7 months' supply of homes available, which is the lowest level of supply since the metric began tracking in 1982. And U.S. home builder sentiment set a record high in October for the second consecutive month. The S&P 500 Index Utility Stock has been the top sector over the past month, and in October, the group now approaching a key bullish pattern known as Golden Cross, where the 50-day moving average crosses over the 200-day moving average. The European Central Bank policymaker Robert Holzmann said that he saw no need for further monetary stimulus at present, while leaving the door open for more easing if the pandemic worsens. And nickel prices have soared to 11-month highs as expectations of robust demand from stainless steel mills spurred fresh purchases, while industrial metals overall were supported by a lower dollar and healthy growth in top consumer China. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, or FDIC, reported that 7.1 million U.S. households do not have a bank account last year. That's the lowest number since 2009. And Goldman Sachs told its clients that a Democratic blue wave on Election Day would unleash the fiscal floodgates and boost the amount of stimulus flowing from Washington. The bank's chief economist, Jan Hatzius, said that a large Democratic Senate majority would bring more COVID-19 relief and infrastructure spending, along with new minimum wage legislation. And mortgage demand from U.S. homebuyers fell for the fourth straight week. Purchase demand has dropped nearly 7% over the last month. And three-month U.S. dollar LIBOR rate hit a record high of 0.21. This is now down more than 100 basis points from highs hit in March at the peak of the pandemic-rated market volatility. The U.S. extended its losses, dollar extended its losses, hitting the lowest level in more than 6 weeks, prompting some traders to ramp up purchases of riskier currencies. And among the Wells Fargo U.S. Retirement Survey, which tallied the opinions of 3,585 workers and 1,005 retirees, 725 who experienced more layoffs, furloughs, or income reductions during the pandemic, 39% of working millennials, 38% of Gen Xers, and 31% of baby boomers are unsure if they can save enough money to retire. I mentioned the housing starts report here a minute ago. Give you some more detail on that. Very, very good housing starts. Following a temporary snag in August, housing starts regained forward momentum in September. Single-family construction rose for the fifth month in a row, hitting the highest level since 2007. Recent reports continue to illustrate the ongoing divergence between single-family and multi-unit construction as the pandemic continues to shift buyer preferences away from dense cities and towards the more spacious suburbs. Single-family construction has now had a full V-shaped recovery, and it sits 7.2% above its February pre-pandemic high. Meanwhile, new multi-unit construction is down 42.4% over the same period. The ongoing rebound of single-family construction is doubly important because the sector has been the lone driver of the upward trend in overall starts since 2015, when the multi-unit sector plateaued, so continued gains remain crucial for the housing market going forward. The recent rebound in starts is even more impressive considering the builders are dealing with multiple headwinds to construction. While home builders have been classified as essential workers in most areas of the country, regulations still require fewer people per crew, dragging out project times. The construction industry also seems to be suffering from an ongoing shortage of workers, with job openings hovering near pre-pandemic levels, while job openings in the broader economy are still down significantly. In other words, there are still lots of unfilled construction jobs that, if filled, would promote a sharper rebound in new construction. Finally, supply chains have been disrupted, and they're struggling to keep up with the pace of new construction. Looking to the future, overall permits rose 5.3% in September, just like with starts. This was entirely due to an increase in single-family permits, which rose 7.8%. This marks the fifth consecutive gain for single-family permits, which are now 12.6% above the February pre-pandemic high. A continued rebound in construction is likely in the months ahead if the NAHB index, a gauge of home builder sentiment, is anything to go by. This measure was released and rose to 85 in October, the highest reading on record going back to the mid-1980s. I'm going to stick a quick one in here and then come back and talk about existing home starts after this. The Carson Group, which we're part of, has added a really neat tax planning software called a Holista Plan, and it's available to us as a service here at Carson Group. And basically, it expands what we call our tech stack. And what it does is it allows us to access the Holista Plan. We have advantage when it comes to planning our current tax situation, not just future taxes. We can upload, and the plan has an upload and read technology. Basically, it saves us time, it gives a consistent report, and it gives us the ability to analyze potential planning strategies. The services facilitated conversations about Roth conversions, Medicare premium surcharges, tax brackets, and penalties. And the Plan One Top, Holistic Plan One Top Honors at the XY Planning Network's 2019 FinTech Competition is discussed as a much in-demand tech offering in this year's conference, which concluded this last week. The tax planning software developer added upper limit tax bracket guardrails and a household organizations feature earlier this year. Really a neat piece of software. You can do a lot of good things. Just scan your tax return. It comes back with all kinds of suggestions. This is Dick Donahue. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to World Wake Up. Dick Donahue with you this Sunday morning. Okay, going to go ahead and talk about existing home sales for the month of September. Existing home sales continued to surpass consensus expectations of September, rising for the fourth consecutive month, hitting the highest pace since 2006. From February pre-pandemic to the bottom in May, sales collapsed 32.91% as lockdown measures and widespread economic uncertainty took hold across the country. Since then, sales have blown past the previous February high, are now up 13.5% from the pre-pandemic levels. One major contributor to the recent recovery has been the Fed's liquidity policies, which have helped push 30-year fixed mortgage rates to record lows, boosting affordability. It also looks like the pandemic and the resulting public health measures have given potential buyers a new sense of urgency, with demand for existing homes so strong in September that 71% of the homes sold were on the market for less than a month. That said, sales face a continued headwind from the low inventory of existing homes. The report showed that inventories were lower than in any other September on record and down 19.2% versus a year ago, which is the best measures for inventory since given the seasonality of the data. This is reflected in the month's supply, which is how long it would take to sell today's inventory at the current price of existing homes for sale, which is now 2.7 months. This is the lowest reading on record back to 1999. And while lower-priced homes are in short supply, inventories have increased in the past year on the upper end of the spectrum. Meanwhile, sales of property worth $1 million or more are up 106.5% in the last year, as wealthy urban dwellers purchase properties elsewhere in order to escape pandemic-related restrictions and social unrest. The shift in the mix of homes sold towards more expensive properties has put considerable upward pressure on median prices, which are now up 14.8% in the last year versus a year-over-year gain of 6.7% in January. So look for continued robust sales in the months ahead, although sales will eventually settle down due to a lack of supply. In other news, on the employment front, initial jobless claims fell 55,000 last week to 787,000. Meanwhile, continuing claims for regular benefits fell 1.024 million to 8.375 million. Finally, on the manufacturing front, the Kansas City Fed index rose to plus 13 in October from plus 11 in September, signaling ongoing improvement in the factory sector. Well, I make a lot of note of this. We spend a lot of time talking about IRA planning and different things you might be looking for. And we've got four tax planning tips for the fourth quarter of this year that we want to take a look at. First of all, we are now in the final review period for retirement account transactions for the year. So we need to perform those last-minute checkups now to identify what opportunities there may be. So December 31st is the cutoff for completing certain transactions, taking advantage of some tax-efficient strategies for the retirement accounts. As we get close to that deadline, a final review should be done to determine whether opportunities remain that should be put in play. To that end, here are four of the many that should be considered. Number one, 2020 is a non-RMD year, allowing more money to remain tax-deferred. Generally, retirement accounts retirement owners who reached 70.5 by December 31st of last year were required to take their minimum required distributions, or RMDs, from their retirement accounts. For employer plans, that can be deferred past 70.5 if they are still working. The age is increased to 72 now for all other individuals. Certain beneficiaries must also take RMDs from their inherited retirement accounts. For some taxpayers, it is preferred that no RMD be taken, so that the amounts remain in the account and continue to benefit from tax deferral. The good news is of these individuals is that the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic or CARES Act waived the RMDs for this year, as we mentioned. As a result, distributions from retirement accounts for 2020 are optional. The waiver applies to retirement accounts that are held by owners and beneficiary inherited accounts. This RMD waiver does not apply if you're in a pension plan. You still have to take that distribution. So tip, if individuals who've had their RMDs pre-scheduled for automatic distributions and do not want to take those accounts distributed should contact us and let us know that we need to cancel those distributions. And there's number two here. No RMDs might be returned and excluded from 2020 income. So individuals who've already took an distribution earmarked as an RMD, and they want to return those to their accounts, they have 60 days this year to do that. The 60-day period starts when you actually receive the distribution. If the 60-day deadline is missed, the account owner might be eligible for a waiver, one of which is the distribution qualifies for a big Coronavirus-related or Coronavirus-related distribution, or CRD, defined in a minute. For a CRD, the 60-day deadline is extended to 3 years. So individuals who miss the 60-day deadline do not qualify for treatment, as a CRD should talk to us and let us know if we can determine if there's other waivers that do apply. The RMD for beneficiary accounts may not be rolled over. An exception applies if the beneficiary is a surviving spouse of the retirement account owner, and the individual may perform an IRA to IRA rollover once every 12 months, which means you can actually move money from one IRA to another every 12 months, actually physically can handle it one time in every 12 months. And it has to be to a similar type of plan, either a non-Roth IRA to a non-Roth, a Roth IRA to a Roth, etc. A rollover of a 2020 non-RMD IRA, a non-RMD is not permitted if it would break this rule. So here's a little tip. If the account is eligible, treated as a CRD, that's a Coronavirus-related development, it is not subject to that limitation. So let's talk about CRDs or Coronavirus-related distributions here for a second. There you got a deadline of December 30th. A qualified individual may take a CRD from a retirement account from January 1st of this year through December 30th. CRDs are subject to a limit of $100,000. In general, a qualified individual for CRD purposes is one who has and who as his or her spouse or household member was diagnosed with COVID-19 by a CDC-approved test or experienced adverse financial consequences as a result of COVID-19. A qualified individual who takes the CRD may roll over that amount within 3 years. So actually you have up to 3 years if you do qualify to roll that over after you receive the amount. The income from the CRD is not rollover and may be spread over 3 years. CRDs, in other words, if you don't roll back over, you got to pay the tax on it over 3 years. CRDs are not subject to the 10% early distribution penalty that applies to distributions that occur when the account holder is under age 59.5. And the Roth conversion deadline is December 31st. Roth earnings accrue on a tax-deferred basis or tax-free when the Roth account owner is eligible for a qualified distribution, such as after the account has been funded for at least 5 years and the owner is at least 59.5. For a Roth IRA, the 5-year period starts when the first Roth IRA that the individual funded. The 5-year period is designated for Roth accounts, usually applies to a second or to a per account basis, and starts when the account from which the distribution is being made was first funded. The opportunity for tax-free earnings in the primary reason why Roth is attractive to taxpayers, many of whom take advantage of opportunities to fund Roth accounts. One of the ways a Roth account can be funded is by converting amounts from traditional accounts. for designated Roth accounts like Roth 401k, Roth 403, Roth Government 457s, the conversion may be done only if permitted under the employer's plan. A Roth conversion can be done directly between a traditional retirement account and a Roth account, or indirectly, where the account is deposited in the Roth account within 60 days after the account owner receives the distribution from the traditional account. An individual who's planning to convert any amount from a traditional retirement plan or account to a Roth account must ensure that the account leaves the traditional account, and money must leave there by December 31st. So here's a tip. Generally, RMDs must be taken before a Roth conversion is done. That is not an issue in 2020, as there is no RMD for 2020. Individuals who perform RMD conversions may no longer have them recharacterized or reversed, and income tax would be owed on any taxable portion of the conversion. Therefore, careful consideration must be given to this strategy before it is implemented. Ideally, a Roth conversion analysis should be done to determine the suitability, and we can run those Roth conversion analysis for you. And as taxpayers wrap up their retirement plan moves and strategies for 2020, once over should be done to make sure that all required transactions are completed on time. That might mean submitting instructions to custodians and trustees earlier than December 31st, as it's sometimes necessary to guarantee processing by December 31st. So contact us with questions and those about those rules that apply to IRAs and other retirement accounts. It's something we spend a lot of time on, being very knowledgeable in that area. Going to be right back.
'Cause there ain't no doubt I love this land. God bless the USA.
Welcome back to Wealth Wake Up. Dick Donahue with you this Sunday morning. Again, if you got questions for us, give us a call, 360-733-1200. Let's talk about the surprising power of the annual exclusion gift. Now, estate planning tends to be complicated quickly. There's an alphabet soup of strategies available: grantor retained annuity trust, special lifetime access trust, intentionally defective grantor trust, qualified personal residence trust, the list goes on and on. But used appropriately, there's many of these strategies that can be very effective. However, you should never forget the surprising power of using your annual exclusion gift. Some states, of course, and do impose their own estate taxes, like the state of Washington. So if you've got an estate that's over almost 2.2 million this year, you are subject to state tax, so keep this in mind. The federal government, however, doesn't impose an estate tax unless you're over 11.58 million, or a rate of 40%, although this 11.58 million exemption is scheduled to be reduced by 50% in 2026, and it could be reduced earlier by future Congresses. Gifts made during lifetime are generally counted against this lifetime exemption. The Internal Revenue Section Code 2503 provides that a certain amount of gifts each year are excluded from being counted towards this exemption. This amount currently is $15,000 per donor per recipient and will be adjusted for inflation in future years. Yearly gifts of this amount are commonly referred to as the annual exclusion gifts. This is where giving money, especially if you were in that state where you've got that $2 million plus estate, to be subject to estate tax, giving away that $15,000 a year can really be good. So let's talk about the basics of this. The gifts are a perfect first step for individuals who would like to reduce their estate tax exposure but aren't yet prepared to undertake more involved strategies. The amount of the estate tax savings obtained through annual exclusion gifting can be surprisingly large. This is because married couples can combine their annual exclusion amounts when making gifts, that a married couple can give $30,000 per year to a child without using any of their transfer tax exemption. When the spouses of children are included, the amount that can be gifted is doubled again, meaning that a married couple can give a total of almost $60,000 per year to a child and the child's spouse without using their transfer tax exemption. So consider, for example, a married couple who have three married adult children. Suppose the couple expects that their taxable estate is going to be valued at $5 million. If both members of the couple were to make annual exclusions to each of their children and to each of their children's spouses, the couple could give away a total of $180,000. That's $15,000 each times two. That's for the husband and wife. Times two, again, times three, each of the three children, to the, including the spouses. So each year without using any other transfer exemption. There's also some consideration about gifting to trusts. In many cases, you might want to gift, you might want to put money in trust. They aren't eligible for the annual exclusion. However, the beneficiaries of the trust have a unilateral right to withdraw a portion of the assets gifted to the trust each year under what we call the crummy rule. So that's something to look at. Then the other one is 529 plans. This is really a good one for you to use. You can use 529 plans to further extend the power of annual exclusion gifts. If a donor makes a proper election on a gift tax return, they can front load up to 5 years worth of annual exclusion gifts in a single year and use no transfer tax exemption. For example, the annual amount is $15,000. You could actually give up to $75,000 in 1 year to a 529 plan. For a grandchild, a married couple could give up to $150,000, treating the entire amount as an annual exclusion for that year and for the following 4 years. So it is something to take a look at. Okay, yesterday I did this. I'm going to go ahead and do it again. It's called Who Pays Taxes? Part of the frustration I have with political season is the misrepresentation of who pays taxes. Believe me, it's not the big guy. It's always the little guy. Let's start with this statement. Businesses do not pay taxes. The consumer pays them. I'll give you an example. Property taxes. We vote to increase our taxes. The property owner pays them. But if the property owner is an apartment owner, he passes them through to the renter in the form of rent increases. If it's a commercial property, they are passed off as part of what we call triple net. Property taxes, maintenance, and insurance costs that to the renter, which they pay on top of the rent that they pay. Then example two, advisory votes on this year's ballots. You got your voter's pamphlet? Well, look in there. Number 33 is a tax on heavy equipment rentals. This is going to be paid by the consumer. This is the guy, whoever they use to buy this, rent this equipment for, he's going to be the one that's paying it, not the equipment operator. Number 34 advisory about is an increase in the business and occupations tax, or B&O tax, on services. This is a tax on gross revenues. This is before payroll. So businesses like ours, we pay this tax on our gross revenues. Before we subtract our payroll, before we have our property payments and rent, before we have our utilities, our phone, you name it. But the service provider passes it on to the consumer in higher fees. Then there's number 35 on your ballot, which is an $1 billion increase in taxes paid by Boeing. This will be passed on to the purchaser of plane tickets. It will be included in the price of the tickets bought by the flyers. Not to mention the impact on Boeing that will have to reduce operations in Washington, costing us jobs, sales tax revenues, etc. Last week, in fact, they announced that they're looking at selling their Seattle area headquarters down in Renton. Third example. Increase in the federal corporate income tax rate from 21 to 28% is proposed by Joe Biden. Well, the consumer pays these taxes, not the businesses. When you buy a product, taxes are included in the cost of goods. So the seller increases their price of goods and services to cover the cost of these taxes, which also may make their product pricing not competitive in the global economy. Again, the consumer pays them. And when we get to the discussions about tax loopholes, we hear all this stuff. Well, you know, basically, most tax loopholes are a consumer subsidy in one form or another. And while I'm at it, let's talk about fracking debate. Fracking has allowed the United States to become energy independent. What does this mean? Well, we've been a net exporter of petroleum products in the U.S. for the last 8 months. This means we're shipping more petroleum and gas products out of the U.S. than we're importing. We are no longer being held hostage by Middle East oil producers. While the military-industrial complex doesn't like it, we no longer have to fight overseas wars to protect our energy supply and our economy. Definitely a win-win. And the result is gasoline for our cars is under $2 a gallon in many states, even as low as 2.25 gallon, which is what I paid this last Thursday at Costco. And this means that more dollars in our pockets to buy other things that we need for our families, groceries, clothes, take a vacation, etc. And when it comes to the cost of natural gas for cooking, heating our home, drying our clothes, etc., is lower, giving us more money to buy the necessities for our families, not having to make a choice. Do I pay the gas bill or do I go out here and buy some extra food or clothes or what have you? So this election season, I've been trying to provide you with information that can help you make educated choices. I've made mine, you make yours. Remember, businesses do not pay taxes, the consumer does. Businesses do not pay taxes, the consumer does. This has been Dick Donahue with you this Sunday morning with 12th Wake Up here on KGMI. Got questions for us, give us a call, 360-733-1200. Don't forget our live shows on Saturday at 11. Again, questions for us, give us a call, 360-733-1200. Thanks for listening. Have a good week and be safe out there.